This nation was founded on the principle that all men are created equal.
We hold these truths to be self-evident.
That all men are created equal.
I'll tell you what freedom is to me. No fear. I mean, really, no fear.
Created equal.
From WDET in Detroit, this is Created Equal with our weekly recap edition. I'm Stephen Henderson, and I'm joined by Carrie Jr. II, the show's producer.
Yeah, we've been a little off with the Mackinac Conference and with the Pulitzer Series. We've been out of our usual routine, so I'm happy to be back in the swing of things, doing our usual recaps and getting to kind of reflect on what this week's episodes were like.
So in this recap, we are going to revisit conversations that we had this week, and they include a conversation about the treaties that transferred native lands to British settlers. We had a discussion that explores the impact of active shooter drills on an entire generation of students. And we talked about why cities are hotter places than other places in America, a really relevant topic given the weather this week and next week, they are saying, here in the city of Detroit. We're going to start by revisiting our talk with Robert Downs about these treaties that were made between Native peoples and Anglo settlers, a lot of them made right here in the city of Detroit and all around Michigan.
Yeah, Downs wrote a book called Raw Deal, The Indians of the Midwest and the Theft of Native Lands. In that book, he really details the history of the battles around the Revolutionary War period and the agreements that came from that, and he highlights individuals in this book, in this history, that we're really familiar with but didn't know the roles they played in these particular treaties.
In this segment we're about to hear, Robert and I are talking about two pretty familiar figures here in Southeast Michigan. We're talking about the roles that Anthony Wayne and Lewis Cass played in these treaties with Native people. Bob, I want to start this segment talking about a figure in our history who is more familiar, I guess, than the history of Indigenous Americans to most of us in Southeast Michigan. General Anthony Wayne is the namesake of the largest county in the state of Michigan, Wayne County. Those of us who live in Southeast Michigan, of course, are very familiar with that name and with the county. But he plays an integral role in the relationship between new Americans, settlers coming here, and the Indigenous people.
Yes, and the namesake of my alma mater, Wayne State University,
right?
Too.
And
also,
right.
he was considered a real tough guy in the mode of Davy Crockett and Daniel Boone way back. And a guy named Marion Morrison took his name to become John Wayne. That's John Wayne was adopted that name.
He's a namesake of Anthony Wayne. That's right.
Yeah. I've got two chapters on Anthony Wayne in the book. You know, Stephen, the biggest loss ever suffered by the United States military, this all ties into Wayne, mm-hmm. was the Battle of the Thousand Slain, it was called. It was Arthur St. Clair, who they named Lake St. Clair after. Mm-hmm. He led an expedition against the United Tribes of the Anishinaabeg, the Potawatomi, Ojibwe, Ottawa, the Miami people, and the Shawnee, and many other tribes. They were holding the line at the Ohio River. And Arthur St. Clair led an army up their way and got his ass kicked from here to next Sunday with more than 800 of his troops and camp followers killed off. And, you know, a lot of people think that Custer's Last Stand was the greatest battle ever fought by the Indians, but that's not true at all. The greatest battles ever fought by the Indians were right here in the Midwest and in Pennsylvania. Well, the upshot of this is that George Washington designated Mad Anthony Wayne to come in and wipe out this alliance of Native peoples. And at that time, there was no United States Army. So this was, the Indians had destroyed one third of the military forces of the United States.
Wow.
That'd be like if we today, one third of the Air Force, Marines, Army, and Navy were destroyed, you know?
Wow.
So this was the biggest, proportionally the biggest defeat in American history. And Anthony Wayne, the native peoples called him the Black Snake, because he crept along with his troops over a two-year period into their territory in Ohio and Indiana, and he never slept. They could never get the drop on him. And he ended up defeating the native warriors at the Battle of Fallen Timbers, which is just a few miles south of Detroit, mm-hmm. maybe 70 miles. Definitely a good day trip for your listeners.
It's down around Monroe, isn't that
yeah,
right?
Yeah, it's Mahomie.
Or is it further
south of Monroe? Okay. Yeah. And anyway, this crushed this alliance of Indians, and it was the first major treaty in which they were forced into a small area in northwestern Ohio, the mighty Shawnee tribe was once one of the biggest tribes in America, and the Miami people. And eventually they too, even on this small area they were granted, they were forced at gunpoint west of the Mississippi
mm-hmm.
to what was then called Indian country, meaning the bleak reservations of the Kansas and Great Plains.
Yeah. So, yeah, go ahead.
Well, it's interesting. Today we have steamrolled all of these Confederate monuments and namesakes and all that, but we still honor Anthony Wayne. Hamtramck was one of his generals. Arthur St. Clair with place names. And we forget that these guys did search and destroy missions against thousands of native peoples live here, mm-hmm. Because after Wayne had crushed the Indians at the Battle of Fallen Timbers, well, he set about burning their orchards, burning their villages, burning their crops, then they would take hostages of women and children as bargaining chips against any remaining warriors. So it wasn't, these people are still honored in their place names throughout, mm-hmm. Fort Wayne, Indiana.
Sure, sure.
Everywhere, you know.
So I want to talk about what the motivation was for General Wayne and as you point out, George Washington, who's dispatching these generals to break up this alliance of indigenous tribes.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, land was one of the motivations, but it wasn't really the only thing that was on their minds.
But mainly it was, Stephen, because in 1791, the first, under the Articles of Confederation, the first American Congress had no right to levy taxes. There was no, yet the new Republic of the United States was stone broke.
Mm-hmm.
And what Washington and Jefferson and the other founding fathers figured out was they had all of this land over the mountains, which all of these settlers were hungry to have. So what they decided to do was obtain the land from the Indians at pennies per acre, or usually far less,
mm-hmm.
and then sell it for a buck or two per acre to these settlers. Now, at the time,
to make money for the government.
Yeah, well, yeah, it was a huge. If Native peoples had been able to sell their land outright, they would have come out far ahead. At the time. There were 10,000 settlers going down the Ohio River in the late 1700s looking for their piece of land. Mm-hmm. Land was everything. If you were from Europe, you had been living for centuries or even thousands of years under the iron heel of a landlord. Mm-hmm. So you could come over here and be a baron practically with this land. It was like unimaginable riches to these dirt poor farmers.
Yeah.
So Congress, at the same time they were scheming to do this, they created what was called the Northwest Territory that included Ohio, Indiana, Michigan, Wisconsin, and part of Minnesota. And they said that as soon as any of these areas gained 60,000 citizens, they could become a state, mm-hmm. which is how Michigan became a state in 1837. Well, just to continue on with this, after General Wayne had crushed the Indian Alliance, the first major treaty in Michigan was the Treaty of Detroit in 1807. And that in that one, William Hull purchased something like 8 million acres for 1/10 of a cent per acre.
Wow. My goodness.
Yeah. And then they turn around and sell it for a buck or two an acre.
Right. And as you point out, it brought revenue to a government that didn't have taxing power.
Right.
Yeah.
It wasn't the first tax in American history was an excise tax on whiskey
right.
in 1794, and that kicked off the whiskey rebellion.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you said something earlier that I want to go back to. You know, I think a lot of people assume or believe that this was being done to unsophisticated, savage mm-hmm. cultures, right? I mean, there's an incredible compendium of depictions of indigenous people in that way. But mm-hmm. but earlier you were talking about how sophisticated and complex their civilizations actually were. I want to have you talk a little more about that in the context of this campaign to remove them from their land by force, if necessary.
Yes, that's an important part of my book. I go into the Copper Age with the Hopewell and Adena and Mississippian cultures, in which they had. They had created these governmental units called chiefdoms. Mm-hmm. Now, a chiefdom would include sort of a capital, generally with a pyramid, a number of pyramids for ceremonial reasons and a palisade. And then there'd be outlying villages. So there were many of these chiefdoms across the United States in Georgia, for instance, the chiefdom of Coosa stretched for 400 miles and had 50,000 residents. Mm-hmm. In Texas, another chiefdom had 200,000 residents. And all of these were destroyed mostly by Hernan de Soto, conquistador who rampaged through the Southeast looking for gold and treasure and spreading smallpox and diseases everywhere. So a lot of what the 1500s have been called the lost century by some historians because of the incredible anarchy and devastation that happened during this time because of these diseases. Mm-hmm. They killed off up to 90% of the people. And so a lot of the tribes that emerged from this catastrophe were remnant tribes, and they weren't as populous or as powerful as they had once been. So they were easier prey for the colonists that came after.
Yeah, yeah. So let's mm-hmm. talk about these negotiations between mm-hmm. The indigenous cultures and the settlers.
Yes.
Why would the indigenous Americans even bother yes. negotiating with the British? I mean, what was
excellent.
The motivation?
Excellent question, Stephen. And there's a very simple answer. when the native peoples first met the French in the early 1600s, they were astounded and very pleased to receive these technological advancements, metal pots and pans, iron axes, steel knives, muskets, manufactured clothing. This made their lives so much easier. Mm. And they were just amused that all the French wanted was, you know, beaver skins, which were all over the place. You know, there were 600 million beaver in North America when the French arrived. Mm-hmm. Well, unfortunately, these traders egged the Indians on to hunt the beaver and other species, fur-bearing species, to almost extinction. And then by that time, a lot of native peoples had lost the survival skills they once had, or had no desire to return to them, any more than any of us would desire to return to plowing a field with oxen for subsistence mm-hmm. farming. Mm-hmm. So what the native peoples had, nothing left to trade, was their land. And they were usually under the gun to trade it, too. And a lot of them had married into these traders had married into their families. And so they egged them on to make these treaties too. Mm. So basically, it was these colossal debts to traders that were a big part of why the native people sold their land.
Yeah.
Now add to that, the concept of buying land initially or selling land was completely unknown to them. If I were to ask you if I could buy the sun or the wind or the clouds, you might say, well, what could it hurt? Right. And and so that was their perspective too. They had no idea what selling land would mean. That land was a commons. And they had no idea that there were 7 million people on the Atlantic seaboard who were just dying to get a piece of it.
Right.
And what it meant to sell their land.
Yeah. Here in Michigan, as you point out, there were many treaties. And they are treaties that bear the names of the places that we mm-hmm. that we are familiar with now. I mean, so many places: Detroit, Saginaw.
Yes.
These are not just names that evoke indigenous people and their culture. They define the transactions that took place that took land from them.
Yes, as you noted, the Treaty of 1807, the Treaty of Detroit, that was a big chunk of southeastern Michigan. And next came the Treaty of 1819, which was the Treaty of Saginaw. And all of these towns, Flint, Saginaw, Frankenmuth, and the like in that area were once Indian villages. And Lewis Cass, who was territorial governor at the time, forced the Ojibwe to sell this land. Well, he didn't, and he did it with the use of alcohol. He was really big on going to these treaties and getting the Indians inebriated, and you know, and they had no clue as to how disastrous alcohol was initially, or how potent it was.
Yeah,
and he had.
I mean,
Lewis
Cass is a name that comes up a lot in controversy nowadays, right? Our most prestigious public high school in Detroit is named for him. We have a street, of course, that WDET is on. In fact, that's named for him, and there are a lot of people who think because of the things he did to indigenous people and as well as to African Americans are reasons he should not be honored that way.
Well, yeah, he had ordered 600 gallons of whiskey to lubricate the Treaty of Saginaw. He mm-hmm. didn't end up with that much, but that was the level he was thinking at.
Yeah. You know, if they're drunk, they won't necessarily be able to think through the deal that you're presenting them.
As a matter of fact, there was one chieftain, Kishkaka was his name, and he was adamantly opposed to selling the land in the Saginaw River Valley. Mm-hmm. Lewis Cass had him kept drunk out of his mind for 10 days while these negotiations went on. And at the end of the treaty signing, he opened up all this whiskey and wine and gin and passed it out. And there was this really wild revel that, nearly turned in. Well, one guy got stabbed and all this, but that was par for the course, you know?
Yeah. That was Robert Downs. He's the author of Raw Deal, The Indians of the Midwest and the Theft of Native Lands. Coming up, we're going to revisit a conversation about the impact of active shooter drills on an entire generation of students. We'll be right back. More Created Equal. Welcome back. I'm Stephen Henderson here with Cary Jr. II, and you're listening to Created Equal. We want to turn now to a conversation we had about active shooter drills and the generation that has come to almost expect not only these drills, but some of the mass violence that is associated with the drills in the first place.
Yeah, this episode was inspired by our assistant producer on the show, intern on the show, Justina Giglio. She wanted to talk about how her generation, the generation of Gen Zers, are kind of defined by these drills and how they kind of grew up with this being a part of their normal drill routine throughout their school years. And on the show, we had three different guests. In this segment, we're going to be speaking primarily to Marissa Ford, who's a student at Grosse Pointe North High School. And she's also a leader at her school's chapter of Students Demand Action. She organizes events there and helps coordinate with the members of the group. And they largely advocate for gun reform. And then Dr. Jacqueline Schildkraut, she is the executive director of the Regional Gun Violence Consortium at the Rockefeller Institute of Government. And her research focuses on schools and mass shootings in the U.S.
And the importance here is the voices that are represented, right? We've got a student who's grown up with this, who had incredible things to say about what that was like. And then we've got these two analysts who've spent a long time really thinking about what the effect of all of this is on our kids and on the generation that is really defined by this whole idea of lockdown drills and mass violence. So I want to talk about your work, but I especially want to talk about the ways in which these shootings and the preparation for these shootings actually affect other things with our children, how they shape academic behavior, behavior itself, this idea of the culture of lockdown and the effect it has on who our kids are.
Yeah, so I think it's really important that we kind of start the conversation, with really clear terminology, because there's a lot of different words that are being thrown around as though they're one and the same, and they're not. Huh. Active shooter drill is a blanketed term that is just used to explain any sort of activity in a school that prepares for an active shooter situation. Mm-hmm. And normally when we're talking about active shooter drills, we're thinking about options-based protocols. One of the most common is run, hide, fight. Of course, in Michigan, as we saw in Oxford, you guys tend to use the Alice protocol. Mm-hmm. And that's very different than a lockdown procedure, okay. Which has very clear steps, can very clearly be practiced. And honestly, when done right, is not different than a fire drill. You're still going to be, going through a procedure and practicing it to build that muscle memory. So I think it's really important to think about, to be really thoughtful about what we're talking about, because those two things have very different impacts on students.
So the teacher we were talking to, though, in the last segment, Ed Huber, made a real distinction between things like fire drills and lockdown drills. He said the steps that get taken and the things that children are asked to do in those drills are very different, and that in his observation, they have different effects on the children. In other words, a lockdown drill has children, in corners, in rooms with the shades drawn and things like that. It's very different than going outside for a fire drill. Do you see that differently than Ed did?
I do, and I think, his points also raised other considerations, but I want to kind of address your question first. Mm-hmm. Any procedure for any emergency is going to have different steps, right? We're not going to respond to a tornado the same way that we're going to respond to a fire drill, because a fire means you get out of the building, and a tornado means you get into the building,
okay,
right? So there's already going to be those differences. So every single emergency is going to warrant a different set of procedures. Now, lockdowns are not tremendously different, if you think about it, than tornadoes or, what older generations dealt with, which were duck and covers, right? Mm-hmm. You are getting out of the way of a threat in a specified area. And so, I think that is what's really important to be mindful of, is what do we know about an active shooter situation in a school? We know that in most instances, and with very rare exception, these are individuals who have less than 5 minutes before law enforcement show up. So that what they're trying to do is harm as many people as possible in the least amount of time. Mm-hmm. So for the people who are inside the building, the most important thing that they can do is to build time and space between them and that person who's trying to harm them. So that's why you get into a specified area of the room, because that makes you be out of sight,
right,
where you can't be seen. And if people can't see you, they can't hurt you. What's been really interesting kind of listening to the conversation to this point is you have very different perspectives in a school building right now that have to compete with one another. You have students who really don't know a world where this is not normal. And, that in itself is absolutely horrible, but does speak to a broader issue about how we've failed to address gun violence in our country. But by and large, when you talk to them about procedures, and I've heard your guests say this today, it's like, we know what we're doing, we're prepared to do it, we've been taught what we're supposed to do, and to them it's a very matter of fact. Hmm. When you talk to somebody who's older, who knows a world where this wasn't, common or an everyday occurrence, it's new, and you have to get their mindset to shift with that conversation.
Yeah.
And that's a lot more difficult to do. So a lot of adults tend to have that sort of pre-99 mentality where this wasn't normal, trying to coexist at a time for, the 2024 mentality where it unfortunately is. And that ends up breeding a lot of tension, in the sense that a lot of the anxiety that I've observed in the projects that we've done have not been the students directly. It's the adults who are, manifesting this anxiety, and that's what they're modeling to students, who then, intercept that anxiety because they're looking at the adults as their protectors. So if we're confident in what we're doing and we're doing it the right way, students are going to feel confident and empowered. When we start, having anxiety or not trusting the process, or we do things like having very sensorial drills that we know are harmful, then you can't wonder why these kids are traumatized.
Yeah. Marissa Ford, I want to get your reaction to what Dr. Schildkraut is talking about here, and the difference in the kinds of drills that take place and the difference in your reaction to those drills. When there are these lockdown drills in your school, how do they make you feel?
I feel like at my school, if we have advanced notice of the lockdown drill, we're usually expecting it, and I feel like that gets rid of a lot of the anxiety for me, at least with a lockdown drill. But when it's when it's something like a threat that's unexpected, then we do tend to be more worried.
Mm-hmm.
But I definitely understand how it increases anxiety in younger children with that announcement, ringing over the speakers over and over again and stuff. And just you have to be completely silent and stuff. And going back to a fire drill, you're like walking outside and like you're supposed to be silent, but like,
but nobody is, right?
Yeah. And but a lockdown drill, I feel like it just feels so much more serious. I don't know. I think it's because we know that the threat of like a gun violence is more common. But yeah. I do think that anxiety sometimes does like spread to other drills though. Like we had like someone like pulled the fire alarm at my school last week, and I was nervous then because I was worried that someone pulled the fire alarm to try to like get us all into a crowd.
I see.
And I was like,
like your mind goes instantly to the idea of some form of violence.
Yeah, because I've heard of that like instance before, and I know we were supposed to, like wait in the classroom when the fire alarm's pulled, but we didn't. Yeah. But yeah.
Yeah. Dr. Schildkraut, I wonder if you can talk about this and whether this is kind of a collective trauma that children like Marissa are feeling about all of this, that because they all experience this either in preparation or in reaction to it actually happening, that they share a trauma experience because of it.
You know, I think that's an important question, but I think that, you know, where we have to be careful is, yes, they are all experiencing it in the sense that we know that 98% of public K-12 schools across this country are doing lockdown drills or some form of an equivalent for active shooter preparedness. But what we also know is that those drills are not all being done equally. And so, you know, Marissa's fears and others who share in those same fears are absolutely warranted. Right. I don't know the way that the drill that she's gone through has been conducted. I can only speak to the ones that I've been part of. But, you know, even from just knowing what we hear about, you know, the instances gone wrong that make news headlines where teachers are getting shot by pellet guns and kids are being exposed to crisis actors and mock shooters and sounds of simulated gunfires. You know, we don't go and set a school on fire to practice a fire drill. So it's really unclear why any building thinks that it's a good idea to simulate an active shooter situation to practice a drill. You know, so I think when we're thinking about, you know, what these practices are doing, we have to account for those differences. A lot of it is not what you do, but how you do it. And so, you know, the same way that we're hearing stories about kids being traumatized, we also have a lot of stories about kids being empowered through practice, where we see a lot of positive outcomes like increased emergency preparedness, lower anxiety, lower fear of harm or perceived risk that they will be involved in a shooting. Those are all outcomes we found in our research because we came to the table using trauma-informed principles from the very beginning. Hmm.
Again, 313-577-1019 is the number here on the phones. Call and tell us what you make of the creation of the lockdown generation in our country. You can also go to Twitter and hashtag created equal or at WDET. Let's start today with Amy in Macomb Township. Amy, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Stephen. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Very good, thank you.
Go ahead.
I'm a former first grade teacher, and I taught first grade for 28 years. I'm getting a little upset here because I've done lockdown drills with my children, and they were drills that we hid in the corner or we all went in the bathroom in the quiet. And I had multiple children crying. We weren't fighting back. We didn't have people attacking us. They don't cry during tornado drills. They don't cry during fire drills. It's part of the reason why I retired 4 years ago. I'm not saying this research is wrong because I'm a huge believer in research, but I think there is a distinction between an active shooter drill and a fire drill and a tornado drill. They're not the same. They're not just.
I mean, the variability here, I think, is one of the wild cards. Amy, I really want to thank you for calling in and giving us that, again, really close-up perspective. But Dr. Schildkraut, it does seem like, you know, there is this variation, of course, but that at the root of this, it is introducing into our children's minds the idea of fear and the idea that they should fear these things. Is that not again introducing a trauma to them?
Well, you know, so I think it's a very, pardon the vernacular, it's kind of a loaded question, right? Because we, you know, I don't want to discredit any of these perspectives. They're absolutely valid, and they're likely due a lot to the variability of what goes on in our country. We don't have national standards for active shooter practices or lockdown drills the same way that we do for fire drills or right. for tornado drills or other things. There's not a lot of guidance out there. You know, and that's something that needs to change. But, you know, I think that the fear is warranted. I'm never going to tell people that it isn't. I'm actually from a community that had a mass shooting, and we were the safest community in America. I grew up in the Parkland area, you know, so I understand that the threat is very real, and having to constantly, you know, think about that and worry about that, you know, absolutely can cause trauma. And things like social media and, you know, media conversations in general, unfortunately, don't help that. You know, to the point that Amy raised, I do just want to speak about something real quick. Mm-hmm. You know, one thing I think that's really important where you can help to offset these negative thoughts or this misunderstanding is training. And I heard this brought up a little bit earlier, and it was talked about like it was a drill, and it's not. Training is where you go through some type of an instruction to learn what you're supposed to do, why you're supposed to do it, and the like. When you go through a drill, it allows you to practice those skills that you are learning in that training. So pairing those two things together actually makes the process a lot smoother. And what our research found is that when you introduce that training, when you're talking to them about, you know, the situation, and listen, we talked to them about lockdown drills. I trained children as young as 3 years old, never used the word active shooter. I said, there's something dangerous in the building and it wants to hurt you. That's it. That's where you leave it. It doesn't, they don't need all of the information per se to know that no matter what's in this building, whether it's somebody with a firearm, whether it's a parental custody dispute, whether it's a dangerous animal, you're going to use the same procedure no matter what the situation calls for. That's what you're going to do. And so when you create those spaces to teach them about that and what they're supposed to do and why they're supposed to do it, like, why do we sit in the room with the lights out? Why are we going to be quiet? You know, why are we going to do all of these things? And then you let them ask questions and you talk about it and have a dialogue. That brings that anxiety and it brings the temperature in the room down a lot, so that when they get to those drills, they feel more confident.
Yeah, yeah. That was our conversation with high school student Marissa Ford and researcher Jacqueline Shieldkraut about lockdowns and the culture of lockdowns in our young people, how we're teaching them that it's normal to be fearful of mass shootings. After a break, we'll be back and we're going to hear a snippet of a conversation that we had with a concrete expert and a tree expert about the heat that we're experiencing in Detroit and how we keep things a little cooler. Back with more Created Equal. I'm Stephen Henderson. I'm here with Carrie Jr. II, and we're about to hear a part of a conversation that we had this week about the heat, the unbelievable heat in Detroit.
It's been bearing down on us this week, and we're going to have a few more days left. It's only Friday, so this weekend's going to be a little hot. Next week's going to be a little
hot all next week.
Being from the north, I'm not ready for it. I'm not prepared for it. So if we have listeners online who are from southern states, they're probably like, these northerners are complaining.
Well, it's just early for us, right? We get weather like this, but not in June.
I don't like it when we get, no matter when we get it.
Yeah, I mean, I think you expect it, though, in late July maybe and August. Then you're like, okay, well, this is our hot time. But this, when it happens this early, you start to get nervous that maybe it's just going to be a hot summer and that we're not going to get a relief from this. But we don't know about that yet. But we did talk this week about how different the heat experience is in cities like Detroit and in suburbs, that because of the way cities are built, because of the infrastructure that we have or don't have there, it just feels hotter. And that's an important equity issue because you have all of these marginalized populations, of course, also concentrated in cities like Detroit. And it's way harder for them to get relief from the heat than other people as well.
Yeah. So the concept we talked about for the show was heat islands. And essentially, like you said, the built environment, the concrete, the surfaces of our buildings absorb heat, make it hotter. And so we had two guests on to talk about how we can reduce the temperatures in urban areas. And one expert is a cement expert. He's the deputy director of the MIT Concrete Sustainability Hub. His name is Hassan Azari Jafari. He focuses on creating a more durable infrastructure for the future more broadly with the MIT group. And then Lawrence Sobson joined us via phone. He's a forester from the Michigan Department of Natural Resources, Urban and Community Forestry Program. So Director Hassan Azari Jafari focused on materials and concrete and how changing those materials can help reduce the temperature. And Lawrence Sobson focused on trees and shade and tree equity. A nice little environmental conversation we had.
Yeah, concrete and trees and heat.
And heat.
Sam, I want to start with you and talk about something a term that the producers here introduced me to last week when we were talking about doing this show. This idea of a heat island, what is that and why does that have relevance right now?
It's a phenomenon that we observe in urban and very well developed areas, that the temperature is higher in the urban areas compared to the suburban areas, even within the same climate. And it's as a result of all the developments that we have in cities, buildings, roads, sidewalks, stuff like that, that we have created a large amount of impervious surfaces in the city that doesn't let the heat go off the city. And that's why we have the warmer climate inside the city area compared to the suburban neighborhoods.
Yeah. I mean, and if you think about it, cities are fundamentally different from other areas. You just start with population density and housing density. That tends to be much more concentrated in cities. So ambient and kinetic energy is higher, and that would make the heat different. But then you also, as you point out, you have all of these things that we do in cities in terms of how we build things and where we place things. That make this worse or more pronounced. But this idea of heat islands, is that new? And I guess the reason I ask that is that climate change, of course, is increasing the average temperature globally, and that's one of the things that I think that we think about when we have heat waves like this. But is this making it worse? The phenomenon, I guess, of this heat island dynamic. Does climate change the way we ought to be thinking about that?
Exactly. So as we see the increase in the temperature and the temperature rise in urban areas, we see that the urban heat island effect intensity will increase as well. The way that we choose the materials for our city surfaces has been impacting the urban heat islands significantly. So the darker the city surface, like pavements or building envelopes or even building roofs, the more heat we absorb in our city areas, and therefore the temperature will rise more significantly. So there are multiple factors from climate change perspective. The increase in the temperature as a result of the climate change has intensified the urban heat island effect, and also the way that we choose our materials or in general, our city surfaces, built area surfaces, will impact the intensity of the urban heat island, and it has been intensifying over the past few decades.
Yeah. So what are the design elements of our built environment that are really problematic? Is it just about surfaces, or is it also about the way we plan and place things in cities?
That's a very good point that you mentioned. So there are multiple factors in terms of the city geometry or morphology, like how dense the neighborhoods are. If we have a denser neighborhood, then we trap more heat between our buildings in a given neighborhood. If we have less greenery space or urban vegetations, then we have less shades in our building, then in our built environment, and then we will absorb more heat. So these are some of the intervening parameters that will impact the intensity of urban heat island effect.
Lauren Sobson, I want to bring you into the conversation here. Your specialty is trees, kind of the opposite of what Hassam Azari Jafari is focused on. Give us a sense of the role that trees play in the way we deal with heat and how hot it is in cities like Detroit.
Yeah, so trees, I think the big factor is shade for the most part. A lot of people kind of consider trees to be either a given or an afterthought, and really trees in urban areas should be considered a part of long-term infrastructure. They're living, but they definitely provide a lot of shade and a myriad of other benefits, as well as stormwater mitigation, stuff like that, that helps cool down our areas, sometimes anywhere from usually from 10 to 15 degrees, which is a pretty considerable amount.
Yeah. So they say the best time to plant a tree, of course, is 20 years ago, because it takes about that long for a tree, many trees at least, to grow to mature size and presumably to provide the most shade. But they also say that the second best time to plant a tree is today, of course. What is the way we should be thinking about how we plan tree planting in cities like Detroit? I mean, we've been doing better in recent years, but of course, practices that we've had in the past and things like disease and kind of wipeouts have affected the way that we're living right now.
Yeah, so in terms of how we're approaching things now, historically, especially in the Detroit area, there used to be a lot of elm trees, and Dutch elm disease came in and wiped them out. And then we had a bunch of ash trees we replaced those with, and then emerald ash borer was introduced and wiped those out. And right now we're seeing a lot of communities in Michigan to be predominantly maple in the canopy. And think of it as an investment. Mm-hmm. You're investing in your retirement, essentially, in a tree. You're not going to buy all of a single stock and hope it stays there for the rest of your life mm-hmm. and beyond. We really want to diversify the species. And what species we're diversifying in, we want species that are a little more climate adaptable to what we're seeing, as well as non-invasive species. So invasive species are ones that could spread and overtake some trees, species that we like, and cause all sorts of issues and have very low quality. Like pear trees are one of the most commonly planted invasive species, and everyone loves their flowers and everything, but they're very difficult to maintain. They break a lot. They don't provide much value. They don't get very big. Versus a native tree called hackberry, which is gets a nice canopy, is much more resilient, is native to Michigan as well as climate adaptable, and is kind of a really fantastic tree and provides a high quality canopy compared to that of other species.
That was our conversation about the heat that we're experiencing in Metro Detroit right now. That is a wrap on the Friday, or the weekly recap. I keep stumbling on that. It's the weekly recap. It's not the Friday recap.
We just can't get that. Well, you know, the weekly recap didn't feel as good with the jingle. So I understand why you all just want to go
to the Friday recap. We liked Friday a little better. Yeah.
So it's a nice conversation we had about kind of the land that we inhabit and its history. And some really kind of eye-opening perspectives from Gen Z. And I don't like the heat. So I'm glad we talked about it. And now we can find some other ways to get rid
now
of it.
Now we can go run through the sprinkler.
Now we can go run through the sprinklers or the fire hydrant or whatever it is that people That's use. Right. To do.
That's it for Created Equal. You can listen to recent episodes at WDET.org and make sure to subscribe to our podcast where you can leave us a rating or a review. Created Equal is produced by Carrie Jr. II and David Lines. The audio editing is by Connor Anderson and the music is by Sam Bobian. Created Equal is a production of WDET, a listener-supported service of Wayne State University.